And we are live. This is Dark Journalist, and it's great to have everybody here for the July 4th special episode. And I know you're all taking time for your July 4th plans, and we've seen some interesting fireworks in the past 24 hours. I'm joined by the lovely Olivia.
Hello, everybody.
You should be hearing Olivia kind of better than usual because her mic is now torqued up and running through the mix. So I hope everyone hears us both just as well, but we'll get more feedback on that as we go along. Tonight we have a very special episode because we're going to tie in all the things we've been talking about to the founding of America and this whole kind of battle at the mystery schools and how it played out over time. And we're going to do it through the figure of Rudolf Steiner, through the figure of Sir Francis Bacon, and through the figures of the founding fathers. When we combine those, we get a better understanding and idea of what's going on here, where the real tradition of America comes from, and how that equates with what we've been looking at with the mystery schools. Some of the more fascinating things I would say right off the bat is that this whole story of America and how it was founded, how it was discovered, and all the rest of it has to be rewritten with new eyes, because we have so much more information now about it. And when we go deep, as we have in some of the studies that I've done, and if you look at the work of people like Joseph Farrell, you will see that the Templars were here and were established here in America far, far before Columbus, and that by the time Columbus gets into his major discovery run, he's actually a member of the Templars, even though they had been disbanded by 1312. There he is flying with the Templar cross on his boats, meaning the tie over from that mystery school is kind of redeemed in the search for Atlantis. And this new Atlantis that he's going to search for will be America, and the new Atlantis myth that arises out of this whole thing is something that comes directly out of the Rosicrucian mystery school, as we'll see through the figure of Sir Francis Bacon. And one of the things that I want to make sure to mention here is that when we talk about the series and the entire thing that we're doing here with the X series, it is based on the X steganography that we've discovered in our research. And you know, in a nutshell, just to get everybody on board, the X steganography is something that shows up in these different programs through the government that go black and then suddenly reemerge with a new name. And it's a way for them to track a lot of this kind of hidden exotic technology that we've covered so much on this program. But what was interesting about it is that all of those stories and all these things that we've found relating to this X steganography, whether it was in presidential letters, as we'll show some tonight, as I always do, that this tie over, this kind of X time capsules, X letters, X information, all of that becomes a pattern of people who know that at some point there's going to be something extraordinary revealed, and they want to reveal their role in it. Now, it looks like that process has been hijacked to me, and that those people would have expected that these things would have come out by now. People like President Eisenhower, President Nixon, and President Kennedy. So, and President Reagan. So when we look at this whole kind of wave of X facts, we're going to show some of them tonight, and the idea is that they've been using this X as a way to move this technology through the different government programs so that they can easily identify it. And what happens in that process is really interesting, because you have all these programs that show up with the X, and they're all competing with each other. And, you know, we have people like Walter Dornberger, who was the famous Nazi paperclip scientist, who gets into this program and creates the X-15, which is still the fastest space plane that has ever been flown. And that was the 1960s. So we're looking at something really quite incredible when we look at this whole X steganography as it moves through history, because what I realized was it went far beyond just the UFO file, which is where the research started, and the whole 1947 cover-up, where they used a lot of X steganography in the FBI reports around it and actually created something called the SMX files, Security Matter X. And those files were handled by someone named Guy Bannister, who worked for the FBI in Chicago, and he was the one who they sent out to investigate all of the UFO cases there in the late 40s. Strangely enough, Guy Bannister will turn up tutoring Lee Harvey Oswald, who's the assassin, quote unquote, of President Kennedy, and he will sort of be tutoring him to look like a communist, even though they're both engaging in right-wing surveillance of radical groups. So it's a very interesting circle that we've tripped into here, as you can imagine. And of course, we get things in popular culture like the X-Files, and they're all kind of riffing off this idea of these X's that have hung around and that are the thing of legend. But of course, the X-Files and a lot of that comes from Frank Scully, which was a case that the FBI tried to really bust. And Frank Scully had witnessed this incredible crash in Aztec, New Mexico, and had written all these stories about it, and was a really kind of well-connected guy in Hollywood. And so they were worried about him blowing the whistle on this, and they tried to make him look bad, and they made up stories about him. But Frank Scully put out the really hardcore books dealing with this subject in the early 1950s, and especially relating to Aztec, which we found out was a major, much more significant in a sense than the Roswell crash because of the things that came up after it and around it, including the work by Bill Steinman on that case. Okay, so let's just take a quick look at a few of the kind of hardcore X things that come into play. One of them has to do with the mystery school, which is Theosophy. That's Annie Besant there at kind of an X festival. She's with the founder, Henry Alcott, with Blavatsky. Between the two of them, they founded Theosophy, and he's going into some kind of a light trance there. But Besant is an absolutely crucial player, as we'll find as we go along. And Olivia, I think I am going to ask you for that second light because I think when we go for the images, it might be better. Something else. Yeah, that's good. Perfect. Something else that's worth looking at. I think we can see that a little better. Hey, want to buy some stock in Keeley Motors? If you are watching this program, you probably would because John Keeley was an inventor very much along the lines of Nikola Tesla, and he was working with this X technology. And at the end of his life, he was closely working with Annie Besant. His life was cut short, probably due to this activity. And Annie Besant, who was the leader of Theosophy, was able to vouchsafe away some of his technology that he had kept. So this X and the treachery around it and the corporate forces that would come in, the political forces and the mystery schools that would seek to hide it and help the public discover it, but in a way that would be beneficial, is a long and interesting tapestry that we've been engaging with in 18 episodes of this series. Now, we're on part 16 here. We have a couple of two-parters. And in part 16 here, we're going into this founding of America, but we're going into the Atlantis idea of America. And when we go into that, we have to understand that the groups that are behind that founding of America are the mystery schools who are very much aware of the Atlantis background of our past that has been rubbed out as part of history because that was a culture that possessed very high technology. And at the time, they used the technology that was meant as a kind of a spiritual interface, which is where this technology goes. And that spiritual interface technology was used by these priestesses and the culture had risen to this level where they could interface with higher beings using what today we would call, like our highest technology, a kind of super laser electrical reactor. And what happened was there were groups inside of Atlantis that used this technology. And this is part of the esoteric tradition that comes out of the Steiner work and out of the Casey work and out of Theosophy, which we finally got our hands on in the 19th century. And which isn't totally well understood. And what happened in that process was there were groups inside of Atlantis that wanted to use that interface technology for physical dominion. They wanted to be able to annihilate, the enemy tribes and things like that. And they also wanted it for domination of the culture and not only their physical lives, but their spiritual lives. So these two groups battled it out. And the aftermath was devastating because whatever it was that happened there changed the Earth's trajectory. It endangered evolution. And there were so many consequences to it that the mystery schools who retained the information and the history decided to pass it down over time and keep this a very, very volatile and dangerous, you know, we'll call it technology here, but it's actually in effect, secret. And that at the right time, you know, humanity would be ready for that story and ready for that technology and will have grown culturally to such a point where their character can assume these things, and then we'll be off and running. And this was the plan of the mystery schools. But unfortunately, as we've gone along here, the culture hasn't moved as fast as the mystery schools would have liked. And there have been attempts to really throw mankind and humanity off of its evolutionary track. So we're going to get into all that tonight. Let's take a quick look at some of the X stuff. And I know very well that there are those of you out there who know the X track quite well, but for all you new people out there. Just interestingly enough, X is our logo for the Dark Journalist show. And this is something that came up when I was thinking of two streams coming into humanity at the same time, and that's where the X came from. But unconsciously, I must have been thinking, I'm going to be working pretty deep on this over time. Here is the X envelope, which is at the LBJ Library, waiting to be opened in 2023, one of the many presidential letters that hang out there with secret information, which is what I call a stealth archive that people can look at and know that it's there, but they can't open it and see it and read it the way we would like to. There's a series of these from Eisenhower to Reagan to Kennedy to Nixon. Speaking of Nixon, I always like to show this. It's a little, just indulge me a little bit. That is the letter. Let's see if I can, there's a little glare on that. We have a letter here from President Nixon. And this is kind of fascinating. It says to Donald Trump in 1987, December 21st, it says, "Dear Donald, I did not see the program, but Mrs. Nixon told me that you were great on the Donahue show. As you can imagine, she's an expert on politics, and she predicts that whenever you decide to run for office, you'll be a winner. Okay, with warm regards, Richard Nixon." Of course, they become great friends. Well, you wonder about some of these connections. And then we think about John Trump, who is Trump's uncle. And he was the professor at MIT and part of the Rad Lab, partners with Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush, the man who was in charge of the UFO file. So there's documented records on that. So Trump and his uncle being in that milieu, the secret technology, and working on the next program. Now, interestingly enough, when he was in South Korea recently talking about the North Korean peace accords, that are coming into being now. It's fascinating. He mentioned his uncle. And, you know, I find this interesting because his uncle vouchsafed some information with him. And he's often, I read an article in the New York Times about how he was close to his uncle. And, you know, Trump has tried to kind of subtly telegraph that my uncle shared things with me. One of the things he said was he shared nuclear with me before nuclear was nuclear. So we'll try to figure that steganography out. Okay, this is John Connolly in the middle, who was in the assassination car with JFK, the governor of Texas at the time. Donald Trump here with his then wife. What was her name again? Olivia. Trump's first wife. Ivanka?
Oh, God, I always get this
wrong. You're always good at that.
Ivana, right?
Ivana, yeah. That's it. Ivanka's the daughter. Mm-hmm. And over here we have Nixon. And that's Nixon and Trump together at this event. That's 1988, and Nixon is trying to convince Trump that he is the presidential material. And Nixon actually predicts and works with him that he's going to be president and starts sharing. Now, you can imagine Nixon, who had been vice president for Eisenhower for 8 years, then president himself before he was removed for 7 years. That's 15 years. And then 5 years in the Senate before that. So really pretty hardcore experience. All those things he went ahead and shared. And I do find it fascinating because when we're looking at the connection between Nixon and Trump, you know, this is something that just wasn't brought out. And it's there in the public record and it's the National Archives. There's no disputing it. But why did they leave it out? And when we got all that information earlier this year about Nixon and how he was so close to the disclosure movement, making actual UFO disclosure documentaries in the early 70s and funding them, then we start to get an idea of what was going on there with Nixon and Trump and how this was very much a succession of steps that were being employed by political forces. Of course, Nikola Tesla, the reason he comes into this a lot, of course, because the X-Tech centers so much on what the types of things that he developed and the kind of wireless energy and so on that were blocked by people like J.P. Morgan. But one of the things that we can say about Tesla for sure is that the expert that they wanted and that they called in to look over his papers when he died to see if there was a death ray in there was Professor John Trump, who was president's uncle. President Trump basically has them not only the benefit of Professor John Trump having worked in the Rad Lab on the UFO file, but whatever knowledge that Trump gained from looking at Tesla's files, the president has that in tow as well. So that gives us a very interesting idea about what's going on there. The other interesting key thing to note, I would say there, is that Professor Trump said that the FBI was absolutely adamant that the thing that they wanted from those papers was the information about a type of technology that could take down, quote, flying objects at a distance. That is, if I'm in Hawaii and I want to take down something that's flying over the UK, I can press a button and do it. That's what they were looking for. And it gives us some idea of exactly why they were monitoring Tesla so closely. And of course, in just a couple of years, the FBI would coin unidentified flying objects. And that's something that they were talking there to our friend Professor John Trump. Now, that gives us an idea when we're looking at that, and we see these programs come out that are all X-Tech. So, you know, the super secret, quote unquote, super secret X-planes that were developed, these were programs that were under the auspices of the paperclip Nazi scientists that we had brought over here. And those planes now are being unveiled. We're starting to get a bigger history of what they were, but they're certainly the most advanced things that were brought into the public. Now, one of the things that I found when I was digging through this is that there was a clash at some point between the people who were trying to get the Blue Gemini program off the ground, and they were inside of NASA in 1960 when JFK was becoming president. And then when he became president, they were like, uh-oh, we've got a problem. Look who's here. So they try to keep it out of his reach. And he did the unprecedented thing of sending in his defense secretary, Robert McNamara, to say, look, you know, whatever it is you guys are cooking up here with, you know, von Braun and all these other people at NASA, you know, we want in on it. And if we don't get in on it, we're going to turn Blue Gemini over to the military, even though NASA is a civilian administration, supposedly. So it was a big clash. I mean, this is something that I think is very underreported. And from the documents that came out in 2014 around it, we can see that the secret space program, which we've done a lot of research on this program, certainly is there in black and white when he says, look, there are two space programs. And he's trying to get to the bottom of it and saying, like, we don't need to spend money on it, but what are you guys doing over there? So Blue Gemini is that thing that kind of hangs out in space. And we've done programs on it in this series, and I highly recommend that people do check that out. Now, we have a lot to get to tonight, so we're going to bring back that whole July 4th Celebration of America vibe again here. We're going to start with Christopher Columbus. Columbus, who is fascinating, who was a member of a mystery school, and here he is flying his Templar sails there on his way to America. Now, the Templars we have to touch on briefly. I did an episode called Akhenaten Prophecy, which, even though it's called Akhenaten Prophecy, deals extensively with the Templars and the whole battle that happened there. That episode is probably a couple of years old now, but it is with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and I do recommend it as kind of supplementary viewing for this episode. Columbus, he's very close to the Queen of Spain, and he is also very close to the Pope, so Pope Innocent VIII. And they're having, you know, he has this whole kind of lifelong endeavor of close connections. And he has this kind of incredible reach. And so this idea of him making this voyage, we have to think about very differently than history portrays it. It's more about, this is a point in history where they're ready to make public the fact that the New World exists. That's a lot different than actually discovering it, which the Templars had done. And there's proof of the Templars having been here. As a matter of fact, here in Massachusetts, we have extensive proof of it. And there are people doing all sorts of excavations. You see so many stories about the Templars being here in America that at a certain point, that's just going to be, you know, the kind of factual information. Right now, we're just ahead of the curve on that. The Templars themselves are a very mysterious group, and they seem to come into being around 1100, and their focus almost entirely was to go recapture Jerusalem and to search for this treasure of the temple. And there was something absolutely vital there, and that was the kind of knight's quest that they had going on. But the order was founded with very high ideals and became incredibly wealthy over time as they became really heralded for the efforts that they made. And incredible people got behind them. One of the things we have to keep in mind is the terrible end of the Templars and what it was all about, and how the papacy was kind of involved in getting all the leaders of it burned at the stake, and then later blaming the King of France over it. Interestingly enough, I went and checked on this to see what the current Vatican word on their role and all that was, and that they said, well, basically, you know, we think that, as it turns out, the Templars weren't such bad guys at all, and we were kind of, the papacy was drawn in to this whole thing. That was basically a political dispute, and that's their way to spin it. Now, interestingly enough, though, the Templars paid the price at the time. And, you know, we have to think to ourselves, what went wrong there? Why were people so nervous about these Templars and their quest to find this treasure in Jerusalem? That's a picture of a one of the major Templars. And, you know, this idea of this quest, I mean, the Templars came out of that mystery school tradition, and that they were following something, a string, a thread about this treasure. And they felt that when, if they could discover that treasure, they'd find the Ark of the Covenant that was apparently buried under the Temple of Solomon. So there's all this imagery there, and we're not going to go too deep into that, but I want to touch on this, which is that, as it turns out, they did find something, and they came back and they talked about it. And shortly after that, there's a lot of reasons why they ran into trouble, but when they came back with that word that they'd found something, things turned very badly for them quickly. And they came under, you know, incredible scrutiny, and they were scandalized in a way by the forces of the day, saying that they, you know, had done all these things in a real, like, kind of, you know, 21st century over-the-top paparazzi way. They were like, oh my God, can you believe what the Templars did? You know, they were beheading children, and they were burning sacrifices, and they're committing, you know, strange acts with corpses and things. I mean, everything that you can imagine in that Inquisition that took place. Anything that they could say about the Templars, they would. They wanted to just besmirch their characters and eliminate them from history. And at the time, you know, everyone was shocked because the Templars had been for over 200 years, this incredibly, you know, venerated order. So something very, very, very strange had happened. Now, Columbus, by taking on this kind of mantle of the Templars, was signaling something also by putting the Templar cross on his boat sailing for America. He knew that the Templars had gone to America and established bases there. And there were legends there, as it turned out afterwards, of these groups that came and traded in South America for silver. And so, you know, a lot of this quest that was going on was treasure oriented, but the Templars had been in the kind of loop of this idea through the mystery schools that America was going to become the new Atlantis. And so the first real glimpse we get of the shutdown, the pushback against that, is when they're burned at the stake, actually. So there's a lot more to tell about the Templars, but we're going to move along on it. A couple of things I want to say about Columbus, however, is that everywhere you go, there are signs of Columbus being tight with the mystery schools. And this voyage that he was on, of course, I mean, he's a flawed character in history for sure, but the voyage that he was on was very important for the forces inside of these schools because they knew America was the next battleground. Because the first real battleground in all of this was Atlantis, and it was these forces pushing to kind of control the evolution of humanity. And in that round, you'd have to say that the darker forces had won through these kind of Atlantean sorcerers. That's the way the esoteric tradition plays. And they always mention something back there. There was something that took place that was so awful that it couldn't be recorded. You know, they talk about the great destruction, and Plato says it was Zeus firing a thunderbolt and lightning bolt and bringing down Atlantis. And we hear from Casey about the two-eye stones pulling out these crystals, pulling down the landmass. But they're describing an effect. Like there's something that a kind of a reality distortion effect. And I've tracked this thing all the way through these stories of Atlantis, through the mystery schools, through the Middle Ages, and into what we call now the UFO file. You know, when people talk about being abducted or something like that, there's this effect. There's like a time distortion effect, and you know, technology goes haywire. And this is the way that we understand it now. And it seems to me when I track that stuff, they're all talking about the same thing. So when I use this term apotheum, I want everyone who's following the X series to see it as a reality distortion effect. And it seems to me the incredible layers of secrecy in the mystery schools is mirrored by the incredible layers of secrecy that we see taking place in the deep state. It seems like the absolute same process is going on. It's like the ultimate untouchable secret. Don't go near them. And the reason for it is, I believe, it's an effect, this apotheum, which they don't completely have a handle on yet. And they're trying to figure out what it is and how to use it for exploitative purposes. Okay, let's take a quick look here. That is Christopher Columbus's, quote, esoteric signature. Now, it's not his normal signature, which I have a copy of over here that looks pretty basic. This is something that he used. This X is always hanging out whenever this comes up. And what we do is we see that there's Latin roots to the way he's presenting this. And some people said, well, you could interpret it as saying, like, you know, I'm the servant of God or something along this line. And what happens is that he's very close with Pope Innocent VIII, and they have this relationship ongoing. And when Pope Innocent VIII dies, Columbus goes into this kind of incredible thing about him, that he was really the founder of the New World, and attributing all these kind of wild things to him. And then he writes on his tomb this mysterious signature. Now, the signature contains a couple of X's, as we've seen, and I think there's steganography going on in this whole act, because what's happening is Columbus is taking on the kind of mantle of the Templars, who had already been to America. He's putting the Templar cross on his sails, so he's identifying outwardly. Now remember, it was the King of France and the papacy that got the Templars destroyed as an order, and that basically crucified their leaders. So this has seemed like a bold thing to do, but it seems like since he's close to the papacy, this group that's in the papacy there, the Pope Innocent group, must realize something else, which is that whoever it was that was helping the Templars back then, the mystery school that was in charge of getting them over to America and all the rest of it, that people like Columbus and the Pope needed their help, whoever they were. And there is, in fact, the story of a person who accompanied Columbus who is not listed in the actual manifest of who came along, but who they do make a point that they left him in the West Indies. And this is an unusual character, and we're going to see as we get to the point of the American Revolution from this American study, a mysterious character shows up again and doesn't seem to have any identity, but he seems to steer the entire event. This is the presence of the mystery schools in these very crucial events. So, of course, when Columbus gets over to the New World, he interacts with the natives, and you know, it's quite fascinating because Columbus, before he left, when he's writing Queen Isabella and he's giving her this kind of description of the New World and how great it's going to be, she's like, wow, you know, this is kind of wild. It sounds like you've already been there. And this is an interesting point because, of course, he had already been here. And we're going to touch on that next. But first, I'm going to check in with Miss Olivia. How are we doing over there?
Questions are all over the place. I guess people have had a chance to catch up on all the old episodes. So
We knew it had to happen. Mm-hmm. By the way, everyone, how are you hearing Olivia? Doesn't she sound great? Because she has the new mic.
I have a new mic.
It's kind of, we're going to get you to sing next. That'll be
God forbid.
No. But you're watching Dark Journalist, and we are on episode 16 of the X series. And this one is all about the Steiner Red Pill and the revelation about the New Atlantis. And this whole thing about the red pill and the blue pill that came out of the Matrix movie, well, what if I told you that that is all directly out of a Rudolf Steiner lecture dealing with the revelation, and that those guys read it and figured it out and put it in their movie? We're going to show you definitively tonight. And then when everyone says red pill this and red pill that, we're all going to know that he's talking directly and referencing directly Rudolf Steiner and the mystery schools. That's going to help part of what's going on now. It's going to bring the past together with the present, which is what this series is all about. While I'm at it, I should mention to you to go to darkjournalist.com to sign up for our newsletter. Wow, we have a great crowd already. Fantastic. The last time, when I first looked, it said 888, which is hilarious. But it's an excellent group to have out here with us on a holiday, because, you know, when people are doing holidays, we know, my God, the last thing they're doing is being on the internet. But hey, here we are. But I knew we had to do the show on July 4th, and it's very important, I think, for us to touch on some of the really crucial factors about how America got formed and how America came up on the radar the way that it has, because America is no doubt the effort of several mystery schools. And it's been manipulated also by several mystery schools, and it is the greatest place to observe the battle between those warring factions, deep, deep, deep in the mysteries. Okay, so one other thing I want to mention here is that in terms of this site, you might notice if you go to darkjournalist.com, we've put something up there right on the front about the X series, right on the homepage. And if you click on that, it is actually darkjournalist.com/Xmaster, which is the master page, xmaster.php. So darkjournalist.com/xmaster.php. That brings you directly into the X series. All the episodes are there with the notes and all the rest of it. And that's where we'll post the information about it and the upcoming shows as well.
Can I throw you a quick question?
Yes, sure.
Okay, Jalar Veer. Ask DJ if he's heard of America being actually named after Amaruka, the land of the winged serpent.
Fascinating. I have heard of that. We know that Amerigo Vespucci is a total farce. Okay, that thing was ridiculous. Now, when I was in grade school, that's what they taught us. Amerigo Vespucci, that's where they named America. First of all, it didn't make sense because it wasn't America, it was Amerigo. And second of all, he himself, it turned out, said later, oh no, you know, because he had a printing press. He was one of the few people who did. And later he wrote some notes and he was like, oh yeah, someone tried to attribute the weird America thing to me. Like, I have nothing to do with it. So that was a farce. The thing is, America, the term, actually comes from the Templars. And that's something that I'm going to show here as well. But yes, does it have a different root that's more along the lines of a wisdom teaching? There's no question about it. And there's a reason why that name is there. And for them not to have to come up with this ridiculous Amerigo Vespucci thing, I mean, come on. You know, when we look at this, it's like the Oswald thing, really, I think about the way that they teach people now. Well, hey, he was the lone assassin. Don't think about it. The history books and the way that things are portrayed are just ridiculous. They're completely not true, including the way that the Vietnam War got started. or what we were doing in Iraq and so on. I mean, the official history is not something that's very helpful to us. But yeah, anyway, great question. Thank you. Let's take a look at someone here. His name is Christian Rosenkreutz. Christian Rosenkreutz is someone who came along in the Middle Ages and proclaimed the Brotherhood of the Rosy Cross, the Rosicrucians. Now, the Rosicrucians, they tried to deny them as soon as he came out with this. They try to instantly kind of push people to the side and repress this the minute that it started to come out. Say, oh, it's a hoax. You know, these guys, they're handing out these flyers and this thing doesn't exist and all the rest of it. In fact, it did. It was an order that had been around for many years, much like the Masons, and had kept information in this tradition of handing it down and felt like the time was right and realized people need to hear this. Now, we've tracked in the 19th century where Steiner has told us about this incident that happened when the mystery schools realized in 1840, hey, this whole place is going to blow because spiritual light is being extinguished by scientific materialism. And the scientific materialism was teaching a doctrine that was simple and incredibly narrow. It was this. Basically, what they were saying was, if it can't be measured, it doesn't exist. So anything that had to do with, kind of psycho-spiritual aspects had to be eliminated. And this put them on a fast track. These papers were coming out of Europe at the time, Germany in particular, and by pretty young people. I mean, I think they were guys in their 20s at the time. And scientific materialism just ruled the roost immediately, much like Darwinism would just a little while later. And they realized that this combination of forces that was happening, the mystery schools saw it as a deliberate attempt by certain forces to dumb down mankind and to take humanity and to lead them along this path where they just lock into their intellect and that's it. And not even use that very dynamically, but lock into a kind of mechanical intellect and lose their spiritual connection, their, psychic vision, their deeper inspiration, and their actual history and their actual evolutionary plan. I mean, it was pretty significant. So what happened, according to Steiner, is that these groups were taking a look at this, and some of them were saying, hey, we have to do something. We have to let out some of our secrets, even though it's uncomfortable, and even though we don't know what will happen. We need to do something against that. And the vast majority of these groups said, no, 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 no. We like keeping this information. We've been good at it. And those secrets, you know, mankind can't handle this, can't handle that. No dice. And by the way, when we put it out there, the kind of corporate raiders and people like that will take advantage of it. They'll abuse the populace and we'll feel guilty and all the rest of it. So this was the nature of this push and pull that was going on between the mystery schools. But a powerful branch inside the mystery schools said, you know what? The more we look at the situation, in 100 years, we're not going to recognize humanity. It'll be complete transhumanism. And they're just not going to have any connection to their real life or their spiritual identity or, you know, understanding of the astral plane, the ethereal plane. All that stuff's going to be shot. So we're going to let it out. And according to Steiner, who I'm drawing on a lot for this, and his work in anthroposophy. And, I just assume people know who Steiner is, of course, doing this show. Rudolf Steiner was the leader of anthroposophy. He was the kind of hardcore German promoter of theosophy for about a decade before that. And he was a scholar at the University of Vienna. He had brought many incredible works on Goethe out, for example. And he had brought works out dealing with Friedrich Nietzsche when Nietzsche was really under attack. So he had a wide range of intellectual pursuits. Take a quick look at Steiner as we talk about him and bring him into the picture here. And Steiner led anthroposophy, which was basically like a Western-based theosophy, where he thought, like almost everybody else, that theosophy had taken this Eastern turn and that there were so many forces working around it. And theosophy, interestingly enough, comes right into the center of our story over and over again. If you've watched this series, you'll know that, because theosophy was the kind of antidote. It was the thing that the mystery schools worked out that they could do. Because Helena Blavatsky was somebody who was so powerful, such an incredible mystic, that they felt, okay, she can handle it. You know, we can help her bring out some of these things to the public. And the situation got out of hand pretty fast, but nonetheless, that was the compromise at the time. That's Rudolf Steiner, after declaring anthroposophy was going to be independent of theosophy. And theosophy had gone off into this direction of saying, we're going to sort of incarnate the world teacher inside of Krishnamurti, who was a young Hindu boy. And this was one of those plans, which is decidedly human, that Annie Besant and C.W. Leadbetter, who were leading the Theosophical Society, took upon themselves to kind of force a result, you know, force the world teacher down here to straighten out the situation now, kind of thing. So you can certainly appreciate where they were coming from, but even Krishnamurti decided to bail out of their plans, and so that left them in the lurch, and it left a lot of their efforts. They did incredible things, and we should never underestimate the power of the ideas that Annie Besant and Helena Blavatsky brought forward from theosophy. But I think that this mission of bringing on the world leader through a channel really was just something that was all too human in a sense. So Steiner's, what I've realized about Steiner, and I want to share this because I've been reading Steiner since as long as I can remember, really, since I was about 12 years old, maybe 12 or 13. And I've been very close to the material over time. And what I've realized about it that people don't really get about him, because I think some people in anthroposophy just portray him more from the scholarly level because they're so concerned about having this be legitimate. They're like, yeah, you know, he created biodynamic farming and eurythmy, and he created the Waldorf schools, childhood education, you know. And by the way, he thinks that Ahriman is out there, which is this incredible soul force. And it's trying to herd mankind into something called the eighth sphere. So they leave that part out very often because, you know, it's a tough thing, I think, to bring into the world. But what I think happens when they leave it out is something kind of crucial, which is we've lost, and Steiner must have foreseen this because, of course, he said himself when World War I started that anthroposophy had failed in its first mission, but that in 100 years and in the window of 100 years to 120 years, and that was 1916 that he said it. So we're talking 2016 to 2036, that another window was going to be open for these mystery schools to come public, like anthroposophy, and bring this information to humanity and general society to change the tone of the evolutionary path of humanity. So he must have known that they were going to kind of keep this stale version going. And I think what they've done with Steiner is something I see that happens with Casey, too, which is they put him in this little box and they ignore the larger strands of the information he brought forward. You know, Casey's talking about in Atlantis times, you know, they have these incredible ships that fly through mountains and that their lasers can devastate a continent and these things, you know. And very often, I think from the perspective, they don't want to sensationalize over there at the ARE, which is an institution I have a lot of respect for, but I think that they can be a little out of touch sometimes with how powerful the information is that Casey brought forward on Atlantis. That's why it's all new Atlantis when we get to the America side. And when, very often they'll portray Casey as, you know, well, you know, he was such a great guy and he was taken advantage of by the world, trying to do good, and he was a Sunday school teacher. And it's all true. But, you know, let's talk about his Atlantis legacy. No one ever talked about Atlantis like that now or since. And, you know, he predicted television and he talked all about basically how the Atlanteans had interfaced with a spiritual technology and had actually kind of you know, disintegrated into this incredible force field of uniting with these spiritual beings. I mean, it's pretty powerful, incredibly heavy stuff. So I think with Steiner, something similar has taken place because you do have anthroposophy. And even at the time that anthroposophy, and by the time Steiner died, in 1925 at the age of 64, there were already splits. He had to reincorporate all of anthroposophy again the year before he died because he felt that there were groups that were taking it into this other direction. And so he wanted to form it, and he felt that the thrust of the whole age we were in was all about the story of Archangel Michael, basically. And he was kind of aiming us in that direction. So Steiner is looking at this whole situation, and he goes back in time, and he tells us about what the Mystery School battle was all about. Well, then we look at things like, you know, when the Fox sisters came forward and they were doing seances and things like that. And, you know, the Poughkeepsie Seer, Andrew Jackson Davis, he came forward and he had incredible vision. He could see directly into the spiritual worlds and stuff. Where were these people coming from? What was this whole craze about spiritualism that was happening at the time? It's a remarkable effort by the mystery schools to see if humanity is ready to dig in on some really hardcore information that has to do with their total reality, you know, the larger picture. Reincarnation came out of that. All the while, there are groups inside those mystery schools that are saying, don't let that out, don't let this out, and battling with them. And some of them, I've identified really three types of mystery schools: the benevolent groups that have different levels of insight and knowledge and manuscripts and information. There's certainly what Steiner calls the left brotherhoods, and C.G. Harrison wrote a very interesting book. And, you know, that whole kind of wave of things, I think these people reporting on it, somebody like Harrison, is also somebody who's a very mysterious figure, comes out of the blue to kind of give us a blow-by-blow about what's happening with these battles in the mystery schools. So we have to kind of see that people are reaching out to us, trying to tell us, as long as we're awake enough to pick up the message. So the information is there. I mean, I'm quite clear on that. I've seen it over and over again. For people who are conscious and looking for these answers, the information is definitely there. So what they're trying to tell us specifically is that this battle that took place in the mystery schools and the things that they tried out, bringing ideas about psychic ability, ideas about reincarnation, ideas about planetary evolution, spiritual evolution, higher worlds, higher realities, higher self, all this kind of thing. This is all coming from the mystery schools as kind of a desperate play against the scientific materialism that has been pushed hardcore by similar groups that are also hidden. And they are under something that Steiner calls an Armonic influence. And Armon is this character that I was stating before that we see a lot of times when they promote Steiner, they never talk about this. But I can tell you from spending all the time with Steiner's work that I have, that he spent 3 decades trying to tell us something pretty simple, pretty straight ahead. I mean, he used a lot of abstract language. He's a genius. He, you know, he could do things in all these different fields, from sculpting to theater to academic historical work. I mean, the guy was really like 5 people in 1. But what he was trying to tell us is that Ahriman is a force that is trying to herd humanity into a different evolutionary track by capturing its intellectual imagination and having its spirit captured inside of that intellectual imagination. It's a difficult thing to describe because the Ahriman force is the traditional devil in a sense. So what he's trying to present to us is doesn't go down easy, you know, because it is a very kind of lofty concept to get into. And the 8th sphere is another thing. It's kind of a false version of the earth. And what happens is, you know, by going into this state of mind of the Armonic forces, which is kind of like scientific materialism, there is no other reality besides what you can measure. And that very kind of scientific intellectual state, which kind of eschews the entire spiritual reality and loses that connection to half of the being, you know, it's a very interesting situation because the person who's doing that thinks they're becoming elite and lofty and all this stuff. And what's happening is that there's this force splitting them in half. So let's take a look at a picture there of the 8th sphere. This is it here. Often times Steiner will draw it interlinked with the earth, which I find fascinating, but it's right there hovering. And I think this is kind of a good setup for us for what we're about to get into. So let's see. I won't spend too much more time on Steiner. This is a picture of the 8th sphere from those very interesting Montaigne cards that we ran across in one of these episodes. The 8th sphere definitely is one of these realms that remind me when we're using 21st century logic, and it kind of, you know, there's a persuasive case to be made that what we're talking about is kind of what we would describe as virtual reality, that we project ourselves into a kind of reality that doesn't exist, and we get trapped there. And it seems like as long as we're not aware that we're trapped, everything's hunky-dory with the forces that push us into that reality. So I'll explain that more as I go, but just a quick look at a depiction here, computer graphic rendition. This is like the 8th sphere. It's right around the Earth, and it's something that, you know, in traditional mystery school knowledge, we understand there is a revolutionary, a reincarnation track that we go into. It's evolutionary, revolutionary also. And that track is something that we're meant to move on to. And if you look at some of the esoteric doctrine of people, say like Edgar Cayce, he's going to say, well, you move here. When the individual left this life, they moved into their Venus, you know, and they didn't move there as a physical body. It's a different type of reality, but you have your awareness there and you go through them. They're like schools. They're like stages of evolution. And so the 8th sphere is something artificial that's been created by these harmonic forces. This is Steiner's doctrine now, moving more into that end of things. And what happens is they're saying, you know, we're looking at this and we've got maybe, you know, how long since that last destruction of Atlantis? That was probably about 12,000 years ago, let's say. So we move into this whole reality thinking about it, saying 12,000 years ago was the last echo in the human mind about this whole thing. And so you have all this time that passes in between, and there we are, grappling with this very same question that took place in Atlantis, which is when they go to use the spiritual technology for physical domination. That's what's going on now. That's what we're getting to with the X series. That's where the UFO file takes us. All those things link up beautifully. And by the way, if somebody doesn't, you know, want to believe in that aliens are involved in the whole UFO thing, you don't have to. I mean, the Aramonic thing is pretty alien enough. I mean, I don't make a big deal out of the alien aspect of this. It's really largely about, when I refer to the UFO file, it's how they've handled the secrecy around that X technology. But I'm perfectly happy to talk about the extraterrestrial part also. Okay, and that's Ahriman. Now, this is Steiner's own sculpture, the depiction of the character of Ahriman. And he has spent now 3 decades of his life trying to describe that with this incredible spiritual ability and incredible intellectual ability. He's drilled the whole picture down to this force trying to move humanity into the 8th sphere. And by the way, having a pretty good chance at doing it, especially in this particular period. He sees that as the great danger. One of the things, there's another shot. This is a book I've got, tried to get my hands on a few times, which is a French book on Ahriman. But this is fascinating because when we look at it, what he's trying to say is, look, you've got all these incredible things happening. And, you know, theosophy says the world teacher's coming in the future and we're all living, you know, the 6th root race and they all have psychic abilities and people learn to trade and barter and all this stuff. Great. So theosophy has a much better outcome planned for humanity. In anthroposophy, though, it's really different if you think about it. What he says is, yeah, all those things are true, but the forces that work with Ahriman could derail the entire evolutionary track. So therefore, we have to pay attention to it. And the best kind of thing for these Ahrimanic forces is if people say, well, I don't want to think about that, that's negative. Then, you know, they're hunky-dory. I mean, that's the kind of thing like saying, well, I don't want to get a burglar alarm because I don't want to think about having a burglar. So we get into that kind of thinking. This whole thing, by the way, the name Ahriman comes from Persian religion. And this really, the Zoroastrianism had a great hero in there. Was Ahura Mazda who took on Ahriman. This is a picture of them doing battle. And this all comes into play in what we're we're talking about. Ahura Mazda is here battling Ahriman, who has a chimeric-like qualities. He seems to be many animals merged into one, and he's incredibly powerful animal. Very often when Ahura Mazda is battling him, he has to keep his hand on his horn and his sword thrust into him just to be able to actually deal. He's incredibly multifaceted, so it's quite a good description. So we have this period where Steiner gets into theosophy and is the dutiful, kind of representative of Annie Besant in Germany and develops theosophy in Germany. And this break that happens where he's no longer with theosophy is not something that he had planned. He didn't want to lead some group against the work or outside of the work of Blavatsky. He was very, very fond of this work. He believed in it. But he felt that they were going now into this Eastern direction because they had been manipulated by other mystery schools to move there, not for any good spiritual reasons. And they had taken advantage of the fact that both Besant and Blavatsky had these very, very destructive lifetimes dealing with Christianity. In the case of Besant, she had been burned at the stake in a previous life under false claims of Christianity. So there's all kinds of history there, but the reason I bring this part into it is the entire concept around America, this whole thing about the New Atlantis and stuff, the mystery schools had preserved this idea of Atlantis, and they knew it was going to rise again in America. And this is where we're going with all this information about Columbus and anthroposophy and all the rest of it. Now, we had seen people like Francis Bacon come out of the woodwork. Francis Bacon is quite interesting. Anyone who's done any good research on him would say he's definitely the best candidate for being the real Shakespeare. As we know, he was also well known as being a major Rosicrucian. So the idea of this Rosicrucian writing all these plays would have raised a lot of red flags. Like, hey, what are they trying to do? Influence the culture or something? What's going on here? And oddly enough, the interesting thing that happened was that it appears that he developed this friendship with an actor who was bright and who was kind of like his mirror image in a way. And that they together created this whole myth of Shakespeare. And that's where all those plays come from. You know, people have cited things like, in his will, Shakespeare didn't leave any of his plays to anybody and doesn't even mention them. It's just these odd things that would lead you to believe that it wasn't so much a big part of his life as it was more of a plan of Bacon. One of the things that Bacon is known for, and I highly recommend people get, is something called The New Atlantis. Here we have directly now Christian Rosenkreutz bringing out this Rosicrucian impulse into the culture, and then people like Bacon picking up on it. Now, one of the wild things about Christian Rosenkreutz is that he, when these groups have looked at him on the esoteric side, they've learned that he was Lazarus, who was raised from the dead, you know, going into that whole Christian symbology that's going on there, the Christian story. Well, this, you know, this would give him a really good reason to be obsessed with the Rosy Cross. But this is Bacon, and you can see he cuts an image that's very much like Shakespeare. But this is another person who I have to say seems like five people in one also. But his efforts at establishing the idea of us creating a new Atlantis, this kind of new utopia, you know, picks up on the theme that the Templars had left behind, who we were talking about a little bit earlier. The Templars were saying, at a certain point, after they had been successful for 200 years, incredibly wealthy, they wanted to form a Templar state, which was going to be a new utopia, a new Atlantis, basically. This is Bacon picking up on that thread, the same way that Columbus picked up on the thread by using the Templar signs on the sails. They were getting this information. That same school that was tutoring and helping the Templars was helping Columbus, now helping Francis Bacon. That school is the root of the Rosy Cross movement, the Rosicrucians. I'm absolutely sure that the Rosicrucian school is the one that goes back really to Egypt and has all that Atlantean connection, that Atlantean knowledge. They come out, you know, maybe in the 13th century. So you might say, well, where's a trace of them back in Egypt? But it seems to me that lineage seems to carry on through, and it's the Rosicrucians who bring it forward. So Bacon, by creating this idea of a new Atlantis, gets people stimulated in the idea, you know, and we should mention here that John Dee is kind of a mentor for Bacon. And John Dee, who is the Queen's conjurer, he has this whole idea, and he always has the Queen's ear, and he's like, we have to get over there. We have to make America into this kind of new place where, you know, he's really created this idea of creating the colonies, and he's pushing that whole thing. But this is early. We're still talking about the early 1500s. So they're looking at it, and they're kind of like weighing it out. And then Dee moves that down to Bacon. He's transferring this image to him. And Bacon comes forward, has this incredible push for Rosicrucianism. And I think what we're looking at with Bacon is really somebody who has an incredible impact on the world. As a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson, one of the most famous founding fathers, said, you know, he single-handedly may have been the most important person in the world. Let's think about that from Thomas Jefferson, who many would consider the same thing. I want to touch briefly here on bringing in this X theme. The Rosicrucians see the human being here as in the center of these forces. There's always this X when we get deeply into the Rosicrucian imagery, and they seem to understand the X as these forces influencing. I've gone to great lengths to show that the X has a great deal to do with time, evolution, the spiritual interface with the physical, this idea that we have about God. It's like the great secret that they need to maintain. And some of them keep it in a benevolent fashion, and some of them exploit it in a less than benevolent fashion. Excuse me. How are we doing over there, Olivia?
Fantastic.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about it?
Well, right now I'm going to ask David Donaway what to read to research all of the topics that he talks about.
Well, that's good. What do we got for questions?
Do you want a question now?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Let's see. Was, okay, well, Titanblood, this one's easy. Was Columbus a bastard son of the Pope?
Well, this is interesting because Pope Innocent has this reputation. And his reputation is basically as, you know, fathering lots of illegitimate children. And so, you know, the line goes, he wasn't so innocent. But the upshot of all that is there's this incredibly close relationship with Columbus and the Pope. And at the end, this incredible, like, oh, he really is the discoverer of the New World, not me, and writing this esoteric signature on his tomb, you would get the impression that there was something more there than just, you know, the regular kind of connection. Not only did they have a mystical connection, but it's probably quite possibly a family one. As we know, he had hundreds of illegitimate children. So, you know, it's an interesting thing for a pope. Okay, what else you got?
Tessa 1111, are we all reincarnated Atlanteans?
Well, it's interesting because Edgar Cayce spent a great deal of time saying that reincarnation moved through these different cycles. And one of the cycles that we were moving through was the reincarnation of all these Lemurians and Atlanteans who had gone down in the technological destruction. So he said many of the people who are leaders now, if you look around in World War II, were all Atlanteans. So he said that group is just going to continue to reincarnate at this point and kind of face the destruction again that they had wrought on mankind at a distant point that's forgotten through that amnesia that takes place. So the answer is absolutely. There's no question. Steiner's work agrees with the idea that the souls who had gone through that, these various conflagrations in the destructive periods of Atlantis. We're coming back to reenact it, basically, and overcome it this time. But the question is, are they going to come out? Are they going to make the same mistake again? This is what we're seeing, a lot of the same mistakes happen over and over again. But great questions. Wow.
That actually is a good segue for the next question, which is James Clements. Atlantis technology was lost to us due to catastrophic tectonic events. Does Daniel think steps have been taken to preserve our technological advancements in case these things happen again?
Yeah, well, humanity lost it, but I don't think the mystery schools did. That's the point. Of course, great things were lost by the groups in Atlantis who had become completely obsessed with power and therefore didn't make the types of moves to preserve the history. There were groups in Atlantis who were the followers of One, for example. And the followers of One, according to Casey, preserved that information about Atlantis in three places. One of the places is under the Sphinx. One of the places is in Yucatan. And one of the places is where the Bimini Wall is there. So this is pretty interesting in terms of how they're vouchsafing it now. I think... You know, when I look at it and I hear about all these underground bases that are kept hidden, and we hear about the activities in space that form a secret space network, I think they do have plans. Absolutely. And when we think about continuity of government plans, I think it's the same kind of thing. But that's a great question. One of the quotes, before we go any further on this, to get an idea of how the revolution is, of American revolution, a revolution in thought, is tied in with the revelation, which I've tied into the red pill revelation for Steiner. Here's a Steiner quote. And what it says is, all we can do is try to gain a clear picture of the situation and really live with that knowledge. This is when World War I hits. We must remember that thoughts are actual dynamic forces. When we think something, it has the ability to influence people and situations. All we can do now is think matters through clearly, living with these true thoughts for just 2 days before being drawn in again by the black magic of journalism. That's how he saw the press. That's how he would say the media is working. They're using a kind of black magic on people, getting them to think in a certain fashion. The black magic of journalism, it'll make a difference, basically, he's saying, even if they take 2 days off from it. And the time might come when we can use this to bring something about or get someone else to do something. It's very unusual language for Steiner. But I think what he's saying is basically that by coming out of that hypnosis and talking and exchanging ideas, it creates an atmosphere. It creates a separate function. It creates a separate dynamic that influences the rest. So very often you'll hear people say, well, we learned this thing, you know, how does it help me to learn about these things? You know, and everyone, very often you get people who come up and say, well, I want to start a movement with this. I don't just want to think about it. I want to, you know, get to disclosure movement or something. And now that's all great, but it could also be an imbalanced thing too, which is if we take the information in, if we understand who the players are, if we understand who the history is, then you can have a kind of coherent response to the actual situation. And you're not running away on a personal dream or getting caught up in your ego or something. So having the actual information is an incredible value. It's like, it's the thing that's been denied, I think, over and over again when we get into these subjects. So this is something that I think we need to take on, which is this period of learning needs to be acknowledged. You know, everyone is so gung-ho saying, I want to do something with this. The thing I think to do is to learn. and that's the way that I've looked at it. There are going to be these opportunities that arise, and with the difficulties that we've seen coming with the transhumanism and the automation of society, this knowledge that has been vouchsafed through the mystery schools and through the groups that came forward in the 19th century, like Anthroposophy and Theosophy, they vouchsafed something that they said would come to fruition in the 21st century. So I think what happens is they understand cycles better than we do. There's like a 100-year period there of gestation, getting the ideas out. And then what happens? there is a rekindling of the streams of thought that they brought forward. That's what we're seeing happening. And I think that's what Steiner is getting at there, and saying all we can do is trying to gain a clear picture of the situation and really live with that knowledge. That's what we're doing here on Dark Journalist. And I should mention here that you should go to darkjournalist.com. Please do sign up for the newsletter. That keeps us in touch with each other. We hear all these stories about social media networks going down, and God knows we've had our own difficulties with it. But in any case, we survived. That's the best way to stay in touch with us. Also, feel free to become a member. You know, you're going to want to be a member. I can tell you that. because over the summer, there are going to be some things that are just out of this world relating to this X series. This is the time to do it. And it's a pretty convenient. Also, I think as far as the numbers go, it's like $4 a month. The other thing that I want to point out is that the X series has its own episode page with descriptions of the episodes and the links to all the episodes now. So there's 17 episodes there. And that page is darkjournalist.com/xmaster.php. It's right on the homepage. You'll see it. There's a strip of images from it. And that's something that I think is important if you want to keep track of the shows individually. Of course, they're here on YouTube as well. And how are we doing over there, Miss Olivia?
Fantastic.
Isn't it amazing how well we can hear Olivia now? Wow. It's incredible. And we're having a fantastic July 4th with you, trying to really get the picture of what was happening with the founding of America and the New Atlantis. So I'm feeling like we're getting closer all the time. What we need to do is take on Steiner's revelation about the red pill versus the blue pill and how that was used in pop culture. That's where we're going to go next. And then we're going to get into the mysterious mystery schools founding America, which I have some really great evidence for. Okay, we all know this picture. That's the hero that we have there. And he is talking to Orpheus, and Orpheus is offering him the red pill versus the blue pill. And as we know, the red pill wakes him up. The blue pill, he goes on living in the Matrix. And this has come to be an incredible tagline in alternative media, you know, like take the red pill. And, you know, so you find some of the most ludicrous people saying it too, you know, about things that don't mean anything. Say like take the red pill around this, you know, but in any case, it's become also kind of a good motif on top of it. Question is, this red versus blue thing, where did it come from? Well, it's quite fascinating because I'm absolutely certain, you know, it's an interesting thing because I have a kind of familiarity and a library of knowledge dealing with the Steiner work. And this one bothered me a little bit when I thought about the red pill, blue pill thing, because it's very similar to something that Steiner had put forward about revelation. And I put it out of my mind for a long time, but then as we got further and further into people using this term, I decided that it's probably good if people know where it comes from. So let's do that. This is a first-time revelation. That is, nobody's brought this forward. And the reason I say that is because I think it's important. Part of the things that happen in independent world and alternative media is very much what happens in the corporate media. Because, you know, I have kind of the advantage of having been in both worlds, and that gives me a little bit of perspective on what happens. When you're in corporate America and dealing with the newsroom, a story will come up and it gets to a certain point, and then if the higher forces don't want you to deal with it, there's a choke point. It gets cut off and moved off. And there's nothing you can do about it as a reporter, you know, like an Anderson Cooper or somebody. That's it. You know, if they say to him, look, you're tracking on an important story, go for it. And then they turn around and say, hey, by the way, you know, you have to talk to Stormy Daniels and ask her about condoms and President Trump or something. So we get an idea there. You know, it doesn't matter how much money you make or if you're on CNN or whatever. Control is control. Now, this had bothered me because the red pill, blue pill thing, there are a lot of themes in the movie, but very often in popular culture, they will not cite Steiner. And they will go off and say, well, you know, I read some fancy other thing, but they won't cite Steiner. And I find that as a kind of subtle plagiarism. And I can point it out in everything from Star Trek to the Matrix movies to other things. And it's, I think it's good that his message gets out in these ways. I just have a little bit of a hang up, I guess, about it, because I feel like the person who came up with the idea should be cited and lauded for their incredible efforts. This is a portrait that Steiner put out called The Red Pillar and the Blue Pillar. Okay, Red Pillar, Blue Pillar. Steiner picture dealing with an occult vision, an esoteric insight. What it has to do with is he's talking about there's a period in time where we have blue veins and red blood. And what happens is the red blood represents the higher consciousness, our ability to tap into and withhold and inhabit the spiritual world while being physical here on Earth. The blue vein is different. The blue vein is the carrier of the blood. And the blue vein is a reality that these higher forces who don't want us to be on their level, that is the harmonic stripe, they don't want humanity to wake up because they have too much fun manipulating them. So the harmonic stripe leaves us in the blue condition, which is the veins before the oxygenated blood. Now, this is such a deep mystery that we need to take two episodes to do it, which is why we're going to do Friday night's show around these themes again, the same themes that we're dealing with tonight. So you can really call this part one of two episodes. But what's happening is he's giving us a message there in this, which is that the blue vein reality, the blue pillar, is the kind of go-along-to-get-along reality where we seek out the world's comforts and we get along in this kind of comfortable reality and move along the track of thinking that we're evolving and doing all these things and isn't life hunky-dory, and we don't consider things on that deeper spiritual track. And then the red pillar represents kind of the difficulties, the burden of taking on the information of the spiritual reality and the spiritual hierarchy into the physical world. Now, the first thing that happens is you become the target of a number of forces that are aware now that you're on their level. And it's very interesting because you can see how somebody would want to take the blue pillar and as opposed to the red pillar, because the blue pillar is kind of an easier life. And you're not dealing with not only difficult forces on Earth, but difficult supernatural forces. That is, the minute that you become aligned with that red pillar, then you become the target of the people who are trying to maintain this blue pillar. So you got your red pill and your blue pill. Which pill are you going to take? And this reminds me of a very unusual story that comes out of a kind of Buddhist tradition in the East. And it has to do, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but it has to do with these people who set out to quest to find reality. They want to find the spiritual reality, and they go through these different things, and three of them set out, and one of them goes along, and he runs into an opportunity to kind of mine silver. And he's like, oh, you know what? This looks great, actually. I have to take this opportunity. I'm off the trail. And he pings off. So the two go on forward. And so along the way, the second one, he meets up with the daughter of an incredible jeweler who's just found this incredible jewel. And he has this opportunity now to be the biggest jeweler in the East. And so he's gone. So you've got one guy left going through the mountains, searching for the spiritual reality. And he goes through all these things, and he runs across this monk who tells him, yeah, I know where you can go to get this, actually, but are you sure you want to do it? You know, your friends bailed out left and right. And there was a reason for that. It's because here on the earth plane, this is kind of the way to go. And the monk is like, you know, just be sure you're ready for this. And the guy's like, well, I traveled all these mountains. I resisted all those temptations and all the rest of it. I think, you know, I'm absolutely certain. So lay it on me. So the guy gives him directions, and he goes up there. And it's 3 days up the mountain, and he ends up at this incredible waterfall. And he sees someone balancing the axis of the earth on their chin. And as soon as he locks eyes with him, he trades places with him. And he has this incredible weight. It's like Atlas, you know, it's that whole myth of Atlas holding the world up. And he yells after the guy who's running away now. And the guy's running into the waterfall. And he says, "Hey, what's going on? What did you just do to me now?" And he said, "Don't worry, someone else will be along shortly." So this is the thrust of that story, which is, you know, it is a kind of a burden. And there's a suffering that's associated with deep spiritual knowledge. And it's not to be taken on in a light fashion. I do think that it's essential, that is, you know, in terms of actual Earth evolution, if you're really going to evolve as a character, as a person, as a being, then there's going to be some suffering involved. And we've seen that over and over again in people's lives. When we've looked at their biographies, they've always gone through that one thing. So I think it's an important thing to keep in mind. And that's what Steiner is presenting here. But I'm going to turn now to a couple of quotes of Steiner. But before I do that, this is more of that. Now, he's got Michael in the middle in this image, and someone worked on this one. But here we have, again, here's the red pillar, the stake around it, human head, and the blue pillar. And this is Michael in the middle trying to get you to do the right thing. but that red pill, blue pill imagery comes from the red pillar, blue pillar esoteric tradition that Steiner brought forward, relating to the revelation and specifically the fourth seal of the revelation. And there's a great, incredible description that I will get into in part two that Steiner goes over on this that I think everyone is going to need to hear. But suffice to say that when we're looking at this and we're looking at pop culture using the red pill, blue pill thing, understanding the roots of it, where it comes from, and giving us that kind of foundation so we're on the same level of where they're coming from, I think is really helpful. Okay, now let's do this. So I've talked about Ahriman, and this all gets into America, by the way, because Ahriman seeks an incredible foothold in America, and the mystery schools try to block him. And then there are other mystery schools that are trying to cash in, and they become unwitting tools of Ahriman. But what is on the other side? What's the side that's trying to move Ahriman out of the picture in relation to America? And the group is the Great White Brotherhood. Now, I've mentioned the Great White Brotherhood. There's an episode, it's episode 12, I think, of the X series that deals more extensively with it. But let's at least touch on it so we know who we're talking about. So here we have actually Blavatsky, who was very well suited, I think, for the position of being with these masters. And this group that's with her are these beings who have moved beyond physical reality, but still can inhabit and influence things on the physical reality from the etheric plane. So they have the ability to make themselves physical and all the rest of it. And very often in the esoteric tradition, you have Casey and Steiner and Blavatsky and these people talking about it. And the people that they're talking about are the masters, like Saint Germain is one of the masters. This is somebody who overcame the physical earth and wants to help humanity evolve. And they have that ability to come back in. And some of these people, like Steiner, like Casey, like Blavatsky, are aspiring to become part of that membership. So the Great White Brotherhood, and the word refers to the ultimate purity in spirit. But their influence, the impact that they have when looking at all this, is that we're dealing with the reality that, you know, they understand that mankind and humanity is the pawn of evil, and that this is part of the evolutionary process. But they don't want humanity to get swallowed up by that. They want them to have that spiritual flow, that spiritual stream, and that's what they're working for. So when they get to the point where they evolve to be able to kind of move out of the system of reincarnation here on Earth and into these higher spiritual realms, they come back intentionally to get everyone else up, you know, give them the same opportunities. So that whole thing, that's where a lot of the Christian tradition will teach us about. Let me just grab this here. And I think you know, there is something I want to mention here which comes into huge play, which is that Sophia Wisdom and the kind of that stream of feminine wisdom that is really, you know, on the vanguard of what's coming in as the next wave that's going to help humanity lift up, is embodied in the that whole Sophia worship that was going on. That is all reminiscent of Isis, and of course the Virgin Mary is the ultimate symbol of that Sophia wisdom. And this is a kind of a combination, I guess, of Sophia and the Virgin Mary. But, you know, when we talk about the Great White Brotherhood and stuff, it's the gender terms just don't cut it. It's more, it's the flow. It's where these spirits are coming in from. And interestingly enough, the next incredible wave is coming from that Sophia wisdom. So let's keep that in mind as we go along here. Let's see, a couple of quick things that I wanted everyone to know about Columbus. One, the Templars were already in America. We're going to get deep into that, but I think the truth is that fundamentally they were establishing the mystery school here. And this was the whole point. Whoever was helping them out and eventually wound up helping Columbus go public about this, that whole wave of knowledge, the New Atlantis, is a setup by these schools to have this culture be the highest culture, you know, have it be the next great leap for humanity. And you have to ask yourself sometimes, how are we doing on that? It looks like the Aramonic train on the marketing side came in really hardcore and made everyone greedy, but we'll find out if that's how it ends up. Okay. So we went through the tomb. Interestingly enough, the thing about the mystery schools is fascinating because Pir Uris, who is the Turkish navigator who brought us the Pir Uris map that shows Antarctica with no ice on it, and where do these maps come from? No one knows. But they mapped out the whole world, whoever it was, and he said he got it from these different monasteries and they had kept it through civilizations. So it's very odd, actually, when you think about it. But he wanted to chime in on Columbus, and he said, well, you know, one thing I know about him is that, one, he had a book, ancient books, and he had ancient maps that told him exactly where to go and what was happening here. So he's saying, you know, he had this, so where did he get it from? So this is the mystery school influence giving Columbus that information that one of his deep contemporaries, Pir Uris, would know, hey, this guy had all the maps. You know, I know because I had my own map, which he got from a monastery. Okay. An odd little spin here is that Columbus's son said before he died that his dad was of the tribe of David. Now, there's been a lot of rumors about this, and I think it's fascinating because Columbus being Jewish would be very interesting because Pope Innocent VIII had both Muslim and Jewish background, which is kind of fascinating. So then when you think about Columbus in this, you know, there was incredible onslaught of aggression towards Jews and Muslims in Spain during that period, and he wouldn't be able to reveal it and get very far in the culture. So I think that's an important point. Okay, so now let's go into moving into New Atlantis. How does this work? And so we've gone into these different stages, but it's really the Revolutionary War that gets us to July 4th and Independence Day and how all this plays in. So before we go to questions, I am going to bring up a couple of interesting points. One, Francis Bacon is deeply involved with the founding of Virginia. He has an incredible focus upon it. Now, there are mystery school traces that go to Pennsylvania, which I found very interesting, long time before the Constitutional Convention happens there. And the Rosicrucians have an incredible foothold there in Pennsylvania, and that's Philadelphia becomes really the center of this Constitutional Convention. Mystery School 1 in place. Francis Bacon in Virginia, Mystery School 2 in place. They're going to put together D.C., Now, something about Virginia, of course, the Edgar Cayce ARE, Association for Research and Enlightenment, is in Virginia Beach. What did Cayce say about why they went to Virginia Beach? kind of interesting. Well, out of one of his readings, he says, Virginia Beach is the one and only true port of the Great White Brotherhood. Now, that's pretty interesting. How is it that the Great White Brotherhood is in Virginia? So, thinking about it, if that's where the foundation is in Virginia, and we know that Thomas Jefferson tries to make Virginia its own country, practically, it spends all this time there, and that Francis Bacon tried to found Virginia and make it this incredible place, it seems to me the focal point of the New Atlantis was Virginia, and that D.C., which is close out there, was that piece of that. That's what they were looking at. But I think we can't miss on that one. So let's take a quick look. Boy, I've got some Manly P. Hall quotes to deal with here. Let's deal with that. And then, Olivia, remind me, please, mm-hmm. not to forget the X-Bunny.
Okay.
How are you doing over there?
Great.
How are the questions, and how is everyone?
Everyone is has rapt attention.
Oh, fantastic. By the way, that's Queen Isabella, who worked so closely with Columbus. And interestingly enough, by announcing this secret of the New World and discovering it, it united Spain. And they really got incredible dividends from that unification. So something was working there in their favor. Let's take a look at some images of the founding of America by on the Mason tip here. Here's some Masonic imagery for us to keep in mind. And now magically in the middle of that, George Washington is going to appear, I swear. There he is. Of course, Washington, like Franklin and like the others, were Masons. They understood that deeper knowledge and they employed it. And that is to their credit, certainly. There are many clues and things that they left. Of course, we see it now in the dollar bill, and we found out that it was Henry Wallace, the vice president who was associated with Theosophy, that caused this to be on the back of the dollar bill. But in any case, the Great Seal was done by the Founding Fathers during the Revolutionary War. And there's a strange story that comes out of some of this imagery and where it came from. But before we get there, let's just get a little more in that Washington as a Mason so we understand what we're talking about here. One thing I want to mention is a story that someone very interesting, it inspired someone very interesting to become president of the United States. That's Ronald Reagan, who was an unemployed guy who was a volunteer lifeguard until he heard the following story and decided to get his life together. And Reagan... If you want esoteric strands around Reagan everywhere you turn. But this story is all about a very unusual figure and this event, which was the creation of the flag. Now, interestingly enough, this story takes place maybe only about 3 or 4 blocks from here. So we're in kind of interesting location tonight. I mean, we're always in the same place, but in terms of the story, hey. So what happens is this, in a nutshell, and I will read some of this, but just to give you the heads up, there's a very unusual guy who shows up and he rents from these people, and he's an older guy, and he never drinks alcohol, and he only has fresh fruit, and he has kind of like a lot of unusual habits, but he's always working with ancient manuscripts. He's kind of like working in the dead of night, and they walk by his place, and he's in there, and you know, he's always great with his bills and stuff, and they love renting to him, and it turns out the people who are renting to him will write a book about their experiences because amazing things happened in the place where they put together, you know, where they lived, and they had these incredible meetings about the Revolutionary War, again, just a few blocks from here. So as it turns out, this guy is so mysterious, but these people show up, and it's Franklin and Washington and all the rest of it, and they're meeting with this guy's family, the guy who rents out to this weird, mysterious stranger, And he writes about it. And he says, you know, yeah, you know, we had some of the meeting of the Continental Congress. A lot of these guys came here and were working on the flag and all the rest of it. And, you know, this strange, mysterious stranger who we've been renting to just popped in during the meeting. We were sitting down to eat, and all those founding fathers knew him so well. And, you know, it was like they'd their long lost friend. And so he goes in there and they say, well, we're going to meet now into the flag. So he says, oh, I'll ask my boarder to leave or whatever. And they say, oh, no, no, no. He's our good friend. He's going to help us do the flag. That's why he's here. So here's this mysterious mystery school member who shows up very unusually. And when the flag is done, there we go, sitting out and cranking out those images and those colors. When the flag is done, this guy packs up and he's gone like that. Mysterious stranger on the scene and takes off. He's out of there. So we get an idea from that that the founding fathers were deeply involved with these mystery schools. We know they were involved with Masonry, and that's we're also already at that during that period of time. You could consider Masonry as a kind of mystery school, but we're looking at something else also. Now I'm going to read directly from the section on Manly P. Hall on this, because I think it's good. Manly P. Hall's book, of course, Secret Destiny of America. Who doesn't know this book? This is a great book. This mysterious stranger apparently shows up again. And the chapter, it's page 118, and it's chapter 17. It's the unknown who swayed the signers of the Declaration of Independence. This story is what made Ronald Reagan go into politics and become president. So it's very interesting, along with a very unusual book called That Printer of Udell's. If you want esoteric information, look at the weird book, The Printer of Udell's, along with The Lighthouse by Charles Darwin. Okay. On July 4th, 1776, in the old State House in Philadelphia, a group of patriotic men were gathered for the solemn purpose of proclaiming the liberty of the American colonies. From the letters of Thomas Jefferson's, which are preserved in the Library of Congress, I've been able to gather considerable data concerning this portentous session. Oh, by the way, I should mention that it was Manly P. Hall visiting the Theosophical Colony in Ojai, California, and A.P. Warrington, who was the esoteric secretary of the society. I like that title, Olivia. What do you think of that?
Esoteric, I love it.
Secretary. I think I'll be the esoteric secretary. Okay.
You're the esoteric president.
Okay. Well, what, so you can be
I can be the secretary.
No, or assistant president. Okay. It's up to you. No, secretary is good. So esoteric secretary, that'll be my nickname. I'll just call you ES for short. So the esoteric secretary discussed with me a number of historical curiosities. Okay. So this is Manly P. Hall talking to the esoteric secretary of theosophy. It was all about his examination of rare old volumes of early American political speeches of a date earlier than those preserved in the first volumes of the Congressional Record. Aha. Well, theosophy, yeah, there they are, right in the heart of things again. Mr. Warrington offered to send me a copy of this speech, and he did. Then he went to India subsequently, and he died in Theosophical Headquarters in Adyar. So he didn't get the big follow-up with him on this, but he got the document. So here it is. In reconstructing the scene, it's well to remember that if the Revolutionary War failed, every man who had signed the parchment then lying on the table would be subject to the penalty of death for high treason. It should also be remembered that the delegates representing the various colonies were not entirely of one mind as to the policies which should dominate the new nation. In other words, if you sign the Constitution and then the British come back and take over, you're going to be the first one hanged. So it's not just a kind of a subtle, light-hearted thing to do. You're really taking your life in your hands. And that's what all these guys were up against. It wasn't just like, hey, we're going to look great signing this document. Trust me. This one, I don't know if I showed that, but wow, that is incredible. So, I'll read a little further. Let's see if I can cut to the chase on this. So, according to Thomas Jefferson, it was late in the afternoon before the delegates gathered their courage to the sticking point to talk. The talk was about axes, scaffolds, and the gibbet when suddenly a strong, bold voice sounded. They may stretch our necks on all the gibbets in the land. They may turn every rock into a scaffold, every tree into a gallows, every home into a grave, yet the words of that parchment can never die. They may pour our blood on 1,000 scaffolds, yet from every drop that dies that axe, a new champion of freedom will spring into birth. The British king may blot out the stars of God from the sky, but he cannot blot out his words written on the parchment there. The works of God may perish, his words never. The words of this Declaration of Independence will live in the world long after our bones are dust. To the mechanic in his workshop, they will speak hope. To the slave in the mines, freedom. But to the coward kings, those words will speak in tones of warning they cannot choose to but hear. Sign the parchment. Sign, if the next moment the gibbet's rope is about your neck. Sign, if the next minute this hall rings with the clash of falling axes. Sign by all your hopes of life or death, as men, as husbands, as fathers, brothers. Sign your names to the parchment, to be accursed or be accursed forever. Sign, and not only for yourselves, but for all ages, for that parchment will be the textbook of freedom, the Bible of the rights of man forever. So, now, they were all disagreeing with each other. They all had this incredible acrimony, and it was not going to go down. And the strange speech saved the day. The mysterious stranger, everyone tries to figure out who he was and all the rest of it. And he had some kind of, not a military uniform on, but they felt like he was wearing something like a uniform. The delegates turned to express their gratitude because everybody kind of got in this haze about it. And they were like, you know what? People started coming up and signing. And there was this incredible outpouring of power. And so at a certain point, the delegates turned to express their gratitude to the unknown speaker for his eloquent words. And he was not there. So he'd taken off. So Bentley P. Hall asks, who was the strange man who seemed to speak with a divine authority, whose solemn words gave courage to the doubters and sealed the destiny of the new nation? Unfortunately, no one knows. His name is not recorded. None of those present knew him. They didn't acknowledge the acquaintance. But he was in the room, and it's odd because the room was locked and it was guarded, and it's not told, and there's no record of the manner of his departure. So this is somebody who definitely, you know, could either put a spell on the guard to walk in, give the speech, and leave. And he was there in that crucial moment. Now, the conclusion, obviously, is that a mystery school adept realized our entire project of the New Atlantis is at risk here. These guys are fighting with each other. If the British come back and take over, it'll be tyranny, and there will be no progress on these incredible, important, esoteric truths. They won't be brought out. There'll be no way to bring this kind of higher version of reality. There'll be no freedom. And basically, this will start the kind of downturn that Europe is in here in America. That's what they were thinking. And so here's this character who comes in. But I have to say, the earlier version where he shows up is quite fascinating, because when they're putting together the flag and all that, there's also this mysterious stranger. Both of those stories give you an idea of the mystery schools mixing directly in with America. And for reasons which they had dealing with this idea that they knew this incredible stream of harmonic influence was coming around scientific materialism, they decided they needed to do something about it. And they knew America was absolutely crucial to that purpose for the kind of spiritual liberation that would eventually happen. It didn't happen right away, but certainly the Constitution was a really good start. And they still try to take apart the Constitution, let's face it.
Couple of
interesting things to draw the line around here. This is a picture of the Templars being burned at the stake, speaking of a lack of freedom. And basically, that is the powers that be in the papacy turning against the mystery school that was taking too much power and planning to found a Templar state, but who also knew all this stuff about America. And one more shot of our friend Columbus, who very interestingly shows up as somebody who was helped, apparently by these mystery schools, to bring the knowledge out that they had, America was there. This was information that was apparently kept, even though they knew it for years and years and years. Now, some say they had reasons which were less than ethical, like the gold mining and the silver mining, etc. But also, something knew the timing as well there. All right, a couple of quick things, and then we're going to go to questions. How are we doing, Olivia?
We're doing great.
Okay, you have your questions ready?
I have tons of them ready.
Okay, I should have mentioned that the questions need to be asked in caps. That helps Olivia see them when that whole thing is moving so fast. I forgot to say that, so you're going to have to forgive me on that one, Olivia.
It's okay.
Let's take a quick look. Actually, you can ask one right now as I switch over here.
Okay, well, this isn't so much a question, but Bethany Green said she heard that the name America has something to do with the ancient Egyptian name for Sirius, which is Merica. Have you heard of them?
Well, it's interesting because Merica is the term that the Templars were using. The Sirius connection, I think, is quite fascinating.
That's something to follow up on.
Yeah, we definitely will go deeper on that. Mm-hmm. So thank you. okay. This is a painting by Rudolf Steiner about these higher forces trying to send down this powerful message. The painting got destroyed, but there are pictures of it left, which I found interesting. This is one of them. There's a few figures here I'm going to point out. This is Archangel Michael bringing down this dispensation handed down from these higher spiritual forces. And this is kind of a weird twist, but in this painting, deep, deep, deep in the background is this character who is a skeleton who has a pen and looks like he's ready to write something down. Now, there's a few interesting things going on here because it ties in, all of this is going to tie together with something we did in the episode dealing with Alice in Wonderland, which is that there are these deeper mystery school mystery groups who are kind of criminal occultists is the term. And they will use these different abilities to block information from coming forward. And very often they elect themselves as holding the information and suppressing it. There's a shot of them working, and they use the rabbit, which is very interesting because, of course, we had the rabbit in Alice in Wonderland. But this rabbit in the Book of the Dead has the X, and he's one of the holders of this wisdom, but not for a good purpose, interestingly enough. So we have to keep in mind there are those out there. Another shot of this from the Book of the Dead. You can't help but notice the X's on all of these figures holding the knowledge and not for a good purpose. So I'm holding the X information, I'm holding the X, I'm holding the X, I'm holding the X, and I'm maintaining this kind of power system. But it's kind of it's basically like a demonic version of holding that information. You know, it's bound to exist, but it is kind of the opposite of revealing the X in the steganography the way that we've seen it. So they are holding this information through and through. So there is a big kind of movement around the Rosicrucian thing. They were going to introduce the information about the X through the various teachings. That's what I've noticed when I've looked at their stuff. And there was a book from the Middle Ages that I found these Rosicrucian themes in. And I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but I want everyone to take a look at it before we take questions. Because right in the middle of it, our friends, the circle of three hairs from the last episode show up again. I found that quite significant because the Rosicrucians were where that tradition of the Alice in Wonderland came out of, as we learned in the previous episode. And here we are seeing in this Rosicrucian book these three hairs again. And the Latin that's down there, I'm still looking, I'm giving this to someone who can translate it, but it looks, from first glance, from what I've been able to ascertain, that it says time and time again with these rabbits. Now, we've seen that symbol of the three hairs go all the way from China, go through India, and go through Iran. We found it in 1600 BC, all the way through the Middle Ages, and we've seen it throughout. There's there are these researchers who are doing this book now about the three hairs, and they are going throughout England, finding it in all these churches in Devon. So something very unusual is there. And what I'm realizing the more that I spend time on it is everyone's looking at them and trying to figure out what is the symbol of them going around and round. And that's a pretty worthy thing to investigate. But I'm starting to realize if we use a logic of the mystery schools, one of the things that Gurdjieff, who came out of these mystery schools, and his movement came out of these mystery schools, one of the things he said was that in the caves at Lascaux in France, that they would tell the different levels that the schools were on by the amount of antlers that the creature had. And now I'm starting to realize that the signature of the rabbits, the three hairs, is actually a signature of a mystery school. And what we're looking for there is a secret mystery school. And we can't put a name to it yet. I mean, they have those three hairs out there. But I don't think the symbol is just a symbol. I believe the symbol is a group, and that they're putting their stamp there. That's what we're looking at, which is a little bit different than seeing, you know, what does that Taurus symbol mean over there? I think what it means is this is a group, and this is our stamp. So that's kind of my realization on that. A couple of quick things from that very unusual medieval document. This one shows some kind of unusual tech in the crest and the heraldry, which I found quite odd. And moving along, this one had the cross swords, but it seemed to me that they were, again, inferring this X with that. It's unnatural. It's not a natural thing that we're looking at with the swords being crossed and clearly displayed. It's very unusual. It's almost like they're blocking in the view of whatever it is under that crest. So I found some kind of odd imagery associated with that. The final thing I want to show you on this line, and I understand that this really takes us wide, but again, using these bunnies as an image, this is a picture of two bunnies with a dog, and something that Olivia termed an X-pen, which I think is a good way to put it, but he apparently is presiding justice over this dog here, and here we have, he's inside of this X dishing out his proclamation to basically, you know, does the dog live? Does the dog die? It's pretty interesting when you're thinking about how these images are played out in the Middle Ages. And, the three hairs myth and the three hairs, you know, hunt of Venus, as they had it called, whatever it represents, in all that literature over all these years, I am absolutely fascinated that nobody knows anything about it. And there are no actual documents referencing what it is. My feeling is that the reference is, it's because of it's a who and not a what. So we don't know who it is. And with that, I am going to move this July 4th Independence Day episode over to Olivia.
Okay, I'm going to start right away. Indiana Joe is asking, are these pics going to be on the website?
Well, what I'm doing as part of being a member, I'm putting together a kind of massive flipbook for each episode. But I am already incorporating some images onto the website that everyone can see. But of course, I'm going to go deeper for people who are subscribing to the series.
Okay. Grandma Tippy Toes, please ask DJ if the mystery schools are at work in today's world and what that would look like.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, this is the whole point, which is the mystery schools realized this period was coming. And You know, the mystery schools are mystery schools because no one can figure out who the members are. So therefore, I'm not going to be able to tell you any more than anyone else, because I do feel that one thing, though, that kind of puts them aside, which is that they always have a counterpart out in the world. So organizations, you know, like Theosophy was the outward organization of that group of masters that was directing the activity of Blavatsky. In Anthroposophy, it's clearly the Rosicrucians who are behind Rudolf Steiner. I don't think there's any doubt about that. So they always have a counterpart. That's the thing to keep in mind. But are they out there now? Yes. Will you find them on Gaia TV? No, because they don't exploit their knowledge, and they don't exploit their presence. They try to keep it secret. They're very much like the X in a sense. The person who sees knows, right? So the X steganography, it's fascinating when we contemplate it, because an X in steganography is different than cryptography. And I've been reading all about this medieval cryptography, and the goals are completely different. You know, with cryptography, you're wanting to show that there's a code that they can't break that will take hundreds of years to break. And you know, the quatrains in Nostradamus are very much like that. But the X steganography is totally different. It doesn't want you to know it's there. So it takes a little extra time and energy. And of course, people who know it's there can see it. That's why we have something with the X steganography in looking at the technological side. When we look at the X planes and all the technology that came out of the UFO file, we have something like the Rosetta Stone now with the X steganography for looking at that stuff. Because I can tell you it transformed. I understood so much more. I mean, there's a lot more to understand, but I understood so much more about what they were doing with that program by applying the X steganography when they would use it. I said, oh, that's where they moved that. That's where they moved this. So it opens things up. And when you think about the Rosetta Stone, before that, hieroglyphs were just a bunch of weird pictures all over these Egyptian monuments. We didn't understand anything about them. But it just so happens that the Rosetta Stone had it in what? It had it in that Greek, so that I would be able to read the Greek part and then the hieroglyphs. And so it's listed in three different ways: Coptic, Egyptian, Greek, and hieroglyphs. So therefore, since I knew the Coptic Egyptian linked up with the Greek, I could now read the hieroglyphs. That's what the X does for us. So that's how the symmetry, that's why, you know, everything is going to open up, I believe, around this when we really kind of we go deep into this research, because we have something now we didn't have before. You had groups before who were looking at things like, I'm looking at this deep state thing, I'm looking at this, you know, I'm a ufologist and I'm looking at that ufology thing. And then you had other people who were interested in mystery schools and all the rest of it. But none of them were kind of, they didn't have the abilities to do all of them. And they didn't realize that there was something that linked them all. But now we have the fundamental basis for an entirely new learning system around all those things: human history, the deep political movements, the mystery schools, the spiritual brotherhoods, you know, and the Sophia wisdom. All this stuff now is wide open in a way I think it wasn't before we brought the X stuff forward. At least that's the potential that's in there. And I can tell you that I feel like with the X material that we have, we haven't scratched the surface. Maybe we've brought forward something like 10% at max of this. I mean, I have lots of incredible information about it. Okay, you're up.
Okay, Brian X0067, DJ, how do you think the mystery schools select their new members? Is it hereditary?
I think that there might be in elite circles a hereditary handing down of this, but I think mystery schools don't actually work like that. I don't think they work on bloodlines at all. There is nothing that is, if you look at the Essenes, for example, the Essenes were outcast from the Pharisees, and they lived in the desert on not much. So they were completely dedicated to a mystical purpose. It's hard to find that type of an individual nowadays, because, you know, it is a world of conveniences, or they make you project that even if things are difficult. But I would say this, that I think the top quality that someone would look for in recruiting someone who was a mystery school potential student would be basically the ability to put themselves aside. So when you have that ability and you see it so much, you know, I have to say, I do see it predominantly in women more than men. But it is the ability to sacrifice something about the self. And maybe that's what being a mother teaches people. I'm not sure, but it seems to me that women have that ability more inborn than a man does. But I would think it would be absolutely crucial, which is the selfless part of it. And when I was recently watching an interview with Krishnamurti, who is a devastating speaker, he said, you know, all of these gurus were coming to him in the 60s, and they came to him in the 60s and 70s, and they were like, they would sit down with him, and all they wanted to talk about was, I have all these great fans, and I have followers in Canada, and I have followers in Trinidad, and I have followers in Africa, and all they just wanted to talk about where their followers were. And he said, you're not a spiritual teacher, you're not a guru, you're not a leader. And they would be like, what do you mean? I spent all this time coming to meet you and all the rest of it, you know? And he would say, well, the first thing that you learn when you work with the mystery schools, the first thing you learn on the spiritual path is that you don't brag. And, it's kind of fascinating because that selflessness is the core principle about how to see reality clearly. And there are a lot of people out there who are self-sacrificing types who are naturally suited for mystery school work. Okay.
Watch show TV. Is there a mystery school associated with the Georgia Guidestones?
Oh, something very strange is going on there. The Georgia Guidestones have a little feel, don't they, of that guy showing up at the Constitutional Convention. Now, we know that the guy's name is Christian, right? Mr. Christian. And he puts all these rules on there. And then there's that weird thing about population and maintaining the population. And everyone says, oh, it's this elite thing that talks about how to eliminate the population or whatever. I'm not so sure, though. I feel like it definitely is trying to create a sort of modern-day Stonehenge. And whoever did it is pretty well-versed with esoteric principles. That much is for certain. But who it is, we still don't know. Okay, what else you got?
Okay, Daphne 18, does DJ see Joseph Smith playing a role in this narrative? Was he connected to mystery schools? That's a whole episode in and of itself.
It is. I think the Mormon story is fascinating. I think that it is connected with a deeper reality, and I do think that the things they talked about, the lost tribes coming and forming part of the Mayan culture, is important. But I think Joseph Smith turn that he took at a certain point, starts walking around in a military outfit, and the things that happened to him when he was in Illinois and all that, and it was like he was founding a nation, and he was going to, he was running for president, actually. Somehow that seems to me to be a kind of a distortion of what was going on there with the real Mormon movement. And that seems to me a left turn. And I know that later Mormonism gets so wrapped up with the CIA that it's hard to see if they had an original purpose, if they're fulfilling that purpose. But I think it's a fascinating religion, and I think there's a lot to be learned by looking into it. I don't think it's like Scientology, for example. Okay, what else?
Okay, Justin Thomas has two linked questions. Were the Knights Templar in possession of alien artifacts, which they reverse engineered long ago? And are there secret organizations in possession of advanced science who silently observe humanity's development?
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, I would refer you to the Akhenaten Prophecy episode with Joseph Farrell and to Thrice Great Hermetica, which is Farrell's book, for the first question about the Templars. They were in possession of something. They had found something. Now, they had went looking, and there's an interesting story in there. Let's see if I can put this in a capsule form. Basically, there's a researcher named Feather who studied what's laid out there as the Temple of Jerusalem treasure. And he realized, wait a minute, these things don't make any sense if you're using Hebrew measurements. It would be so much like treasure, it's like half the world practically. But he traced the treasure that they were looking for to Akhenaten's treasure that he left before they took away his city, Amarna. And he said, when you do it with the Egyptian measurements, it makes perfect sense. And then it's been theorized now by Pharaoh and others that what the Templars found was the link from the Temple of Jerusalem to a very early Akhenaten Egyptian tie. And that this tie basically was something that the church found heretical, because it would have to say the entire doctrine of Christianity goes back to Egypt. And they didn't want to do that. But also along with that, that they found something that Akhenaten had vouchsafed. And that was what the problem was all about. Now, tying in with all this story, there's a weird thing that that the Pope, after the Templars came back and said they had found this thing, he sent people on a mission to find the crowns one of the crowns from the jewels from Lucifer's crown. So this is very unusual stories around this, but you can tell that they're getting at something important in terms of the artifacts, and something that would have maybe turned the traditional story on its head in terms of where all of this information came from. Have you ever noticed that the Kabbalah is very similar to the Egyptian mysteries? And, it does make you wonder this kind of the roots of where these traditions go back to. So, yeah, absolutely fascinating. Are there groups who have advanced science and are keeping tabs on humanity and doing tests on humanity? There's no question about it. One of the things that happens in science is when you get to a certain point and a certain development happens, then, we get into the situation where the next guy jumps on and he's like, he's a different type of scientist and he works on your material and so on. When you change that curve, you know, just like with space development or anything else, when you move the curve into private hands and you have a different group working on that stuff in secret, then nobody gets the advancement anymore. That's why we look at things and we say, well, in America, we don't even have speed trains or whatever. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. So, we're living in an archaic fashion compared to the information that they have. So there's no question that applies to science and medicine also. So yeah, great questions. Okay. Wow, terrific questions and a huge crowd here. I want to make a point to say happy July 4th to everyone. I hope your fireworks are all the good kind, and that I really am thinking that, one of the things that would be good for us to stay in touch with each other, go to darkjournalist.com, sign up for the newsletter. It's free. What happens is you basically get the newsletter once a week in your inbox. And, it's the kind of thing where you'll just get a list of shows and updates directly from us. So that's something I think that's important for us to stay in line with each other. And in terms of social media, the other thing you can do is sign up at the newsletter, send that into us. You can subscribe to the site and become a member of Dark Journalists. It's very inexpensive and it supports the work that we're doing here. And that's something that you can do. The other thing I want to mention at darkjournalist.com is there is a listing of the X series now there, of all the episodes, and 17 episodes. And then this one is 18, even though it's part 16, because we did a couple of double episodes. So, but make sure you do that. And remember darkjournalist.com /xmaster.php. That's the master page for all the episodes. So keep that one in mind. And now to your next question.
Okay, we're going to pivot to Russia for a minute. Cece Jarvis is asking, the Russian mystery schools are coming out. Any evidence that Putin may have been a student?
Well, it's interesting. You're smart to be... it's very timely to be tuning into Russia, because what's happening is in the Steiner work, he says that the Russians are still connected with their ethereal body the way that we're not in the West. So I find that quite fascinating, because that means they still have the ability to apprehend that spiritual psychic reality in an easier way. So the things that might come out of that are fascinating. And remember, Russia's only been free, or relatively free, as you would say, since 1990, it's about 25 years, basically, since all that happened. So there's all kinds of movements and things that could flower there. Now, we know that there's a very famous Casey reading where he predicts that Russia will someday become the hope of the world. So, yes, a lot. There's a lot going on with Russia, absolutely. And are there mystery schools there? Yeah, they're probably easier to hide, I would say. I remember that Gurdjieff, who did a lot of teaching in Russia, of course, very often people think of him as a Russian philosopher instead of a Greek one, but he said that the schools had all these operations in these caves. Where? In Afghanistan. It's so weird to consider the incredible campaign that we had against bin Laden and the Taliban, where we were bombing the bunker busters with all of these, you know, these caves and all the rest of it. You have to wonder who the real target was. Okay, what else you got?
Okay, also on Russia. What about Rasputin? Is he tied to the mystery schools in any way?
Well, he was fascinating, and he was definitely in the Tsar's court, and he had an incredible influence. So he had that kind of Gene Dixon role that I've talked about, where, you know, these people have those soothsayers, they have those seers, they have those astrologers, and in those leadership positions. The reason in the popular culture that things of that nature have been, you know, kind of turned into this kind of funny thing is it's easier to do these things in secret and to rule over people using these techniques if people don't know that you're using them. So, you know, there's such a kind of a lineage there. Abe Lincoln using our friend there, Emma Britton, you know, these figures are there and they're advising, because anyone who's in power, who's smart, knows that there are lots of different ways to get information. And I do feel that when we look at some of those things dealing with people, you know, in these different leadership positions, like Gene Dixon advising presidents all the way from FDR to Reagan, it's pretty significant. It makes her really, when you think about it, one of the most powerful women who ever was on Earth, because she was giving these incredible decision-making information, insights to presidents like Nixon, and having them change plans. And, you know, so absolutely powerful. Okay, we'll take a couple more questions.
Okay.
There's a quick quote I want to read from Steiner also. So yeah, keep on trucking.
Well, FaZe Templar was asking, Casey says that the hope for humanity comes from Russia, and Brent Simpson just asked, do you think the Russians in touchness with their etheric body has a lot to do with the food they eat compared to our food stuff?
Well, the whole thing that they banned GMOs, I think, was quite significant and played into the whole tension between America and Russia. You know, there were these corporate forces playing around with them, and they were like, you know what, we can ban GMO here because they want their crops to live, and they care about, you know, their farmers apparently more than we do. So we were in the real throes there. But what happened was Monsanto went down and became part of Bayer now. And now they're trying to hide what they do under this. But one of the great things about the type of awareness that we generate when we talk on these shows and the things that we can share together here is that, you know, it was largely the alternative media that looked into Monsanto and the GMO, Frankenfood and all that, and really ran them out of town in a way. Now they're coming back in a new guise with tons more money. But I do think it's interesting that they got that really bad reputation, because in the final analysis, you know, people don't want to eat a food that's been genetically modified, especially on a planet which is rich in, you know, the most incredible fruits and vegetables. anywhere. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a real good example of open journalism.
Now, John has a really great question to put in right here, which is, please ask DJ if vaccines are to numb or destroy the indigo children.
Something is wrong with what happens with that connection with vaccines and the combination of the entrainment from the iPhones and smartphone devices. That combination seems to be making some type of a person who can't function. You know, I'm not sure it's aimed just at indigo children. It seems to be aimed at a group, but certainly it would certainly have a negative effect on anyone with those types of abilities. So yeah, that's fascinating. Quick quote here from Steiner on his pillars, which I didn't get to, which would be a shame to miss. Red pillar, blue pillar. Let's not forget it. Okay. The red pillar. I'm going to read more of this lecture in the second episode on Friday, but let's do this. The red pillar represents the oxygen necessary to create new red blood so that human beings can take into themselves the tree of knowledge through the red blood. The other tree, the tree of blue veins, the blue pillar, has been taken away from the human being in terms of human mastery over it. It contains the used blue blood, which is a poison filled with death. Before the human being descended from the bosom of God, it was the tree of life. By becoming earthly, the human being was divided into two parts, comprising the venal and arterial, the blue and the red blood vessel systems. This is the blue pill, red pill. The blue blood streams up to the heart and must unite with what the plants give. The human being breathes out carbon dioxide. Plants breathe in carbon dioxide and breathe out oxygen. In this way, human breathing, which expresses itself in our actual I-ness, that is, I'm aware of my I, is an intertwining of the red and blue blood trees. This is, however, only possible if the human being has a tool, and that is the plant, without which the human being cannot live. The plant is what allows us to intertwine the blue and the red blood trees. The alchemy of the human being is this. What the plants do us for us today, human beings in the future will be able to accomplish within and through their consciousness. What is outside the human being today will be intertwined within the physical body when we have taken in the entire plant world. When we have expanded our consciousness to include the entire world of plants, that is the future condition of humanity. Then what exists outside in the natural world surrounding us will be entirely different. Our entire cosmos will be changed with us. Now, the final quote on that is this, and I think it is fascinating, the red and the blue, the blood and the vein, now we're understanding. What will bring human beings to that point is the union of the red and the blue blood streams by means of an expanded consciousness. This is indicated with two metal pillars. These are the two blood streams, and the sun is what will be dot, dot, dot. There's an omission in the manuscript from this lecture. Then the blue blood tree will no longer be a tree of death. So, zap, with the mystery school knowledge right there, but obviously he was getting at something. This is a fascinating lecture, by the way, and that's called Reading the Pictures of the Apocalypse. I highly recommend it, and that's part four, dealing with the fourth seal of Revelation. Now, we've brought in a lot of different kinds of information in this episode. We're going to take a couple more questions, but I do want to say this. When we get to the founding of America, when we get to the mystery schools behind Columbus, we get to the mystery school push against scientific materialism in 1840. These are all movements that are connected through time and history. And the period that we're in now is riding on the battles that took place back here with the mystery schools in the early 20th century. So we're looking at this 100-year window that has opened up again, as Steiner predicted that it would come again, and theosophy predicted it would come again. And if you look down the period of time of these different people that were players at that time, like Blavatsky, Steiner, and Besant, they all talk about this period that we're in as this opening that would happen, because their version of it, their ability, anthroposophy and theosophy, to bring out a new world was basically stopped by World War I. So the backup plan is on. Okay, let's take a couple more questions.
So effing bad dude says, what you're saying is that there's an active conspiracy to stop the evolution of men by blocking the pineal gland.
Well, blocking the pineal gland, I think, is probably a good way to do it, because if that's the seat of your third eye, then I would agree with you. There's no question that there's, in the harmonic forces which come down to us, you know, have you ever talked to someone who is in the psychological profession, for example? And they're trained just to think in psychological terms. Now, there are deep psychological terms and things that people can look at from a psychological lens that will be incredibly helpful. And if you look at like Jungian psychology, it's so deep that you get a real understanding of your mind and your emotions. But I'm talking about the kind of flat psychology, the one that says, oh, you're depressed, well, I have a good pill for you. You know, here's a great new treatment. You're going to love this. You'll feel better in no time. A new pharmaceutical company is happy. It's quite fascinating, because that limited thinking, that is the epitome, I think, of what he's getting at here with the threat of scientific materialism. Because all the professions and all the things you go into don't allow you to think. And I think this is essentially the problem. People have told me this when they're talking about politics. You know, you start talking about certain things and, oh, you know, can't talk about that. Catherine Austin Fitz has told me when she was talking about financial things and all these people were predicting doom and gloom around the dollar falling and all the rest of it didn't happen. And she never predicted that. She always predicted a slow burn. And she said, well, you know, the reason I was right was because I considered the black budget and all the rest of it. And all these people who are great in every other way would say, oh, I don't want to deal with the black budget. I can't deal with that end of things. So it is the shutting off of the different sources of information, I think, in these different professions, from psychology to finances to journalism. That's why I'm here, because I think in traditional corporate journalism, there's no way I would have the kind of freedom to look into the things that I know about and that require deeper insight. You know, there would be an editor or publisher somewhere that would have told me, hey, you need to go cover Stormy Daniels and, you know, her affair with Donald Trump. So we're here for a very different kind of purpose, and we have the ability to independently report on these things. So that's really what we're doing with dark journalism. Okay, what else you got?
James Clements, Richard Dolan has said the elites allowed for a greater middle class to advance technology, and then once successful, they plan for massive depopulation, a brave new world. What does Daniel think?
I don't know. Has he said they plan for massive depopulation? I'd have to see that to really attribute it to Dolan. Well, I think there's no question about it that the middle class has been whittled away and whittled away, and they've made smaller and smaller, have less power, more centralized control. And I do think when you have a vital middle class that you have the ability for great changes throughout society. So it definitely is a target of those forces that want to do that. I'm not sure that they're up to depopulation when they do that. I think that it's a consolidation plan. But I do think that when talking about technology, we're getting, you know, you're getting right into their backyard, because the more we understand about technology, or in this case, the X technology, or, you know, things like Tesla technology, for example, the less power they have, because their entire ability to rule over the populace comes from the financial power that they have by controlling the energy systems. So, and the currency. So you run into that discussion when you think, what is it that they have in mind? So if they, you know, we go back to this Fitz question, which is, who are the powers that are really controlling things on Earth and why are they acting the way that they're acting? It has to be the fundamental question over and over again when we deal with this. Okay, we'll take two more questions, and then we'll end our July 4th extravaganza.
Okay.
And I do want to mention this, which is we're going to come back on Friday in our normal time slot there at 7 p.m. And we're dealing with the really deep Mayan mysteries around the X. So it's the other end of America. It's that deep ancient thrust of when Atlantis comes to the Mayans, and then the Mayan mystery school effect. So all of that is going to be included in the next run. And we're going to talk about just the foundations of the mystery schools. That's on Friday at 7 p.m. So even though we're here tonight, we're going to be back on Friday. Okay, what else you got?
Kathy Carr 207, when are we going to have a true independence from the globalist deep state?
Wow. Well, you and I both are waiting for these things. The important thing is that with the freedoms that we do have, that we exercise them wisely so we don't find ourselves wasting our time doing the wrong things or on hating the wrong people. One thing I really want to call out that I see going on, and we see with all the, you know, these movements like Q and all this kind of stuff. The problem in the alternative media is it needs its energy in order to grow and progress. But it's created this platform, which I call 2 Minutes Hate from 1984. And 2 Minutes Hate was that period of time where they would take all these people who were in the party and all these people who were, you know, kind of in this mundane reality, and they would put them in front of a screen and they would give them somebody to hate. The Goldstein was the character who was supposedly plotting against them. And they would make them hate the screen. And then it was a weird catharsis that kept them, you know, it put them in this mind control state, and then they went back to work and all the rest of it. We don't want, I think, in independent media, I get more and more away from the term alternative media because I don't feel like I'm anything to do with it. But I think in independent media, what you see over and over again in these circles is giving them this character to hate and then really hate on. And that's not always a good thing. I think that it's more important not to use our energy on resentment or on wanting to overthrow and that whole thing. That's not where I think it is. I think it's the steady thinking through on what they do that takes power away from them. That's, I think the hate thing is very Aramonic. You know, it's a big dream, if that makes any sense. Okay, we'll take one more.
Okay, I love this question, although it's worded a little strangely. Kendall Gilbert, of those drawn to your work, what does DJ attribute the collective needle on the compass of truth of our being here tonight, and indeed through the X series and all the dark journalist work, a la Casey Soul Groups, Karmic Propensities, etc.?
Wow.
Yeah.
I think someone just let off some incredible fireworks too. Well, that is fascinating. What an incredibly well-worded question, and right to the point too. We have an incredible audience here and incredible viewers. People in the chat are fantastic. And the questions that they come up with, I think, are absolutely fascinating. Why they're drawn to this work, I think that there's a fundamental quality in what we're doing with dark journalism, which is that we will take the deep kind of conclusion and we will move with it. That is, there's not going to be a shutoff point to where the information goes. And I think we have the ability, since we're including things that deal with the deeper political reality, with the mystery schools, with the black budget, you know, and we've been helped along the way by people like Joseph Farrell and the incredible insights of Catherine Austin Fitz. You know, and brave people like Alexandra Bruce from Forbidden Knowledge TV. There's so much information to draw from that wasn't there, say, 5 or 6 years ago, that I think that we all come together at this time in that window that it seems like it's eerie in a way, because you think that people like Steiner were foreseeing this period when this would happen. But we do have this opportunity, I think, and it's the opportunity that draws us all together to the knowledge and the understanding. But I never try to explain it because there's a mystery in there that I almost don't want to know because I'm too busy being glad that there are so many people who can understand and get the message, I would say. And, you know, I think we learn together. This is the thing. I mean, as it turns out, I'm doing research and presenting it to you because that's what I do. I'm a dark journalist after all. Mm-hmm. But I learn a lot from the things and the reactions that people have and the things they contribute. So therefore, it's a really a co-creating process and it's a co-understanding. And we are, I think, all interacting in that. And that's really the kind of vital exchange that I look for when I do this kind of journalism. And with that, Miss Olivia, I have to say I have a surprise for you.
What?
But I don't think it's the only surprise you have coming your way.
Okay.
But I want you to keep it in mind. And this is really something that could get a little messy, so I hope you have a paper towel. But this is a special, as you can see there.
It's my dinner.
It's a special July 4th cupcake. That is for you.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And the reason that I have one is very interesting. It's because I have a surprise for you. Mm-hmm. Which is that probably no one else knows, which is that we, this weekend, will be celebrating Olivia's birthday.
Yay.
So no way better to do it than on July 4th.
Yes.
So, thank you so much. We had a great time tonight. And this looks terrific, too, by the way. I didn't light it.
I want to get started.
It's going to, it's, but make sure you light it and blow it out. And
absolutely.
We had a fantastic crowd tonight. I wanted to shout out to some people. And let me know if I missed anybody. Rika, the hopeful volunteer?
Yeah, I don't know if I saw Rika tonight.
Good old Rika. We'd get her on sometime. But it's great to see everyone. We had Najat out there. Indiana Jones. Indiana Joe was out there. Thank you so much. And it's great to see everyone. We had Titan Blooded is out there. Mm-hmm. Great questions. David Dunaway, always asking really great questions.
Fantastic.
And we really appreciate that. We will be back on Friday at 7 p.m. We're going deep into the Mayan mysteries of the X-steganography. And the Mayans are absolutely fascinating because their influence is felt more and more all the time.
Super creepy. Are we going to talk about crystal skulls?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you guessed it. There's a big piece with the crystal skull in there. Ice Angel is out there. Thank you. It's great to see you, everyone. We will be back next week. And Olivia, what can I say?
All right. I'm ready to eat my cupcake.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
And we will see you all on Friday. Happy July 4th.